I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. More than 26 million Americans have applied for unemployment benefits in the last 5 weeks because of the economic shutdown. While they will receive some money to help them through the crisis, for many, it won't be enough to meet their basic needs. Food pantries have seen longer lines and new customers, new recipients because of the pandemic. This growing demand for food has put food banks on the front lines of this public health and economic crisis. Today on Radio Times, food insecurity in the age of coronavirus. And we begin with the heads of two local food banks. Reverend Zuline Wilkinson, is head of Chester Eastside Incorporated, which is in Delaware County, just outside of Philadelphia. And Reverend Wilkinson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's so nice to be with you, Marty.
Well, thank you so much. And let me introduce Gerald Davis. He's head of Touch New Jersey, which is in Camden, obviously right across the river from Philadelphia. And Gerald Davis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. Thanks for letting me in.
Absolutely. And to our listeners, lines always open, and we don't actually have phone lines quite ready for you, but there are lots of ways that you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave us a comment on your Facebook page, especially if this issue really speaks and touches you in a very personal way. Gerald Davis, let me begin with you, but I want to hear from you, Zuline Wilkinson, as well, just how much you have seen an increase in the demand for food since this pandemic hit.
Marty, we're up approximately 50%.
Wow. And these are new people? These are people that have been laid off from their jobs?
New faces, different locations. We're centered in North Camden, but we see people come in from Burlington and Philadelphia and Salem.
How about for you, Zuline?
In our area, we have seen an increase of about 150% in new clients who are coming into the food pantry. And so these would be people who have not used our services in the past.
And Zuline, let me go back to you. Do you have enough food for everybody?
We are so blessed to have the generosity of so many donors, restaurateurs, churches, individuals, philanthropic groups that are helping us with this whole issue. We're also a part of the USDA programs that are in practice, the temporary assistance for people who have food insecurity. We also receive mitigation foods from the USDA Department of Agriculture, and I think you'll probably hear more about that from your second guest.
Absolutely. But what you're telling us is, at least as of now, you're able to meet the demand.
We have been able to meet the demand through the generosity of many, many different organizations and people.
How about for you, Gerald?
We haven't been able to meet the demand. And as the Reverend pointed out, there are regional facilitators and distributors, two of which the major ones we're very, very happy to be able to participate with is Philabundance, which is a major Philadelphia regional distribution, and South Jersey Food Bank. Both of those have really stepped up their programming, and additional foods are coming in both from, quite frankly, the government as well as private donations, and we're able to take advantage of those. Yesterday we had, when we opened, 150 people in line waiting for, and that represents families, waiting for foods from those people.
Yeah, go ahead, Julie. It sounds like you want to add something. Yeah, go ahead.
In a place like Chester, which is really a very small community, we had yesterday 50 families come through our program. And so any week we're serving at least 100 people and sometimes more. So this is about a 7-mile area in Chester, and food insecurity is really great here.
And Gerald, I've also been reading that while this is an urban problem, it's also a suburban and rural
absolutely
problem. And I think
we
shouldn't forget that. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're immediately next to Cherry Hill, and we have as many participants from the Camden County Cherry Hill area as we do from other areas that would be less astute. Camden City itself has about 77,000 residents, half of which come through our facilities at one time or another in the course of the year. Right now, they're coming through about monthly.
Mm-hmm. Gerald, I also read, I think this was April 15th, so last week, that your group got something like 14 pallets of ham delivered. I don't know how much ham that is, but tell us how that happened and what happened to the food.
So that's directly compliments of Phil Abundance. They've upped their game, as well as South Jersey Food Bank, but Phil Abundance is our home supplier and has been for about 6 years. Listen, Marty, when you're in a situation like this and you have this overage, this surplus that's coming, you need to have organization. And organization, as the Reverend also knows, falls into about four or five areas. Number one, it's supply. And that has to do with Phil Abundance and South Jersey Food Bank. You need to get the food to be able to supply it. Second is transportation. It's one of the biggest issues that we deal with. And we have four or five groups of transportation to help it get it there. And third would be areas like services. Because when these people come out, they look for other services. And you want to be able to help and provide. For instance, we have United Health there on site to provide services for people in Medicare. But the hams themselves were delivered directly from Phil Abundance. We divided them down. We had 9 pallets is what it came down to.
How much ham is that? I'm just curious.
It's about 1,000 pounds a pallet.
Wow. A pallet. So 14,000 pounds of ham.
So we got 9. We actually 9,000 pounds that we distributed over at Allie Hackett's site in Mount Airy. We put 3 pallets there. We put 3 pallets in Camden, and we put 3 pallets in Marlton, New Jersey. And that went through the day. First thing in the morning, right about 3 o'clock, everything was gone.
Everything was gone. Wow.
What I think is really important, Marty, is to understand that hunger masks a number of other issues in our society. People are hungry, and there are reasons underlying why people are hungry. And often we don't think of that. We think that people don't want to work or people are unable to work. Yes, disability is a big issue, but employment is a major problem. And if people are working, but they are the working poor, they find that their dollars don't go as far as the month when it comes to taking care of their hunger needs. We also need to look at age. Chester is a food desert. And so in our community, we meet the government standard of having a high percentage of elderly. We have no supermarket in our area, in the city. We have very limited public transportation. And the need is so great. So there are other issues surrounding hunger that we may not often think about. Health concerns, lots of things contribute to food insecurity.
And just to pick up on that, and I will be talking with our third guest about this in more detail, but I do think this pandemic, Reverend Wilkinson, has revealed a lot of holes in our safety net that have been there all along, and now we're really confronted with them.
We certainly are confronted with those issues. When we receive donations, we are so grateful, and we've gotten some limited funding from some foundations in our area, and we're so grateful for that. But administering food programs is another big concern. We would not be able to do what we do without the tremendous support of volunteers. And in this pandemic, our volunteer base has been reduced by 50% because people are sheltering at home, and they themselves feel vulnerable in leaving their homes to come and to assist others. We've had to make modifications in terms of how we present the food, and we're not allowing groups of people into the building. We now are distributing masks to people who appear and who don't have a face covering. So there's been lots of changes that we hadn't anticipated, but we've had to incorporate as a result of this pandemic.
Yeah,
we have an unusual advantage. Is we've been able to partner with the CSEP program and the Workforce 55 programming, where we bring volunteers in. To their benefit, the State Department of Labor, State of New Jersey, allows us to team up as a nonprofit 501c3 and bring volunteers in that are 55 and older from that programming from the state, and basically do the volunteer work there. They're paid a minimum wage for somewhere between 15 and 20 hours a week. Mm-hmm. And as the Reverend knows, when you talk about volunteers, you talk about reliability. So there's a stress.
Yes.
In the
yeah.
conditions that are there, do they show up? Will they hurt you? With the additional food that's necessary to get out, you need people to do that, and you cannot, yeah. quite frankly, count on the community vis-a-vis the physical concerns. So CSEP and the 55-plus program brings volunteers in for us, and they're there 15, 20 hours a week, and they solve a lot of problems mm-hmm. for us. That's a good teamwork right there.
That's
well, and Gerald, just a quick follow-up. I'm assuming they have masks and gloves and taking all the
Absolutely.
Precautions that are necessary.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, yeah. I jumped on you, Reverend Wilkinson. Go ahead. Did you want to add something to that?
Well, in a place like Camden with a program, as he describes, that's a real benefit. We've had some RSVP volunteers come to help us during this period. However, our volunteers are basically community volunteers and volunteers from nearby suburbs, Wallingford or Swarthmore, and they are completely volunteer. Mm-hmm. We so appreciate them because our pantry would not operate without their support.
And that's so good to know. Let me go back to you, Gerald Davis. You mentioned the fact that yesterday there were something like 150 people waiting in line at the food pantry. Is there 6 feet between everybody? I'm just wondering how much you and perhaps others can monitor just to make sure that people are safely distancing from each other.
Well, let's just say I'm tired at the end of the day.
Are you? I mean, just keeping people apart?
Exactly. Exactly. You're in line. The police cooperate, too. The police in Camden are great, and they're there, and they watch, and they correct as possible. But you're dealing with a very, very stressed-out environment and a clientele that basically they see somebody who's 4 or 5 ahead of them. They're leaving with a nice chicken or so. So they're obviously looking. We do our stuff outdoors now because it aids and abets the service and moves things a lot quicker. Transportation is the biggest thing. A lot of times we have mean transportation people who bring the food while the people are in line because it goes on refeeding as we go through, and they want to get up and they want to see that. They want to see the food that Miguel's Pharmacy brings in and Kenny's World and Mike Lanier's group from God's Daily Bread. They're there unloading the food in order for the people, and the people are anxious. They want to get to it.
Have you seen the same thing, Reverend Wilkinson?
Well, actually, we have streamlined the way we operate. We are lining up outside. We have signs posted at 6 feet distances, which say, in English and in Spanish, distance 6 feet. We also have put tape on the parking lot grounds at 6 feet distances, and people stand. They've been very, very orderly. We then allow people in one, no more than two at a time. We have prepackaged bags for lunch that we're giving. We're no longer doing get meals right now. So we have a breakfast, lunch, and then meal bags, 18 meals. Per person.
Hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break and then we'll be back to our conversation. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm talking with two heads of some local food banks, and in about 10 minutes or so, I'll be talking with Mariana Chilton from Drexel University about food insecurity, even beyond the coronavirus pandemic. Reverend Zulene Wilkinson, head of Chester Eastside Incorporated, that's in Delaware County in Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. Gerald Davis of Touch, New Jersey, that's in Camden. And again, you can join us, send us an email radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Reverend Wilkinson, you were saying right before the break, before I had to jump in and take us to that break, that you're handing out essentially prepackaged foods.
Yes, we're handing out prepackaged bags, and each bag contains 18 meals per number of people in a family.
Wow.
So that is really significant, that people have enough food for 6 days, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And in addition to that, we have over this period been able to add an additional breakfast and lunch package for people who need this.
Is that a big bag? That sounds like a lot of
food. It is a lot. It is a lot. So when Gerald talks about transportation, it is a major concern. People who have, for example, four members in a family are probably taking home 4 bags of food.
Wow, which is a lot of food.
And it's heavy.
And it's heavy. Let me go back to you, Gerald Davis, and I'm thinking about those people that are in need of food in Camden, let's say, but they're not going to make it to your food bank. Maybe they are elderly. Maybe they have disability of some sort, or they don't want to be in line at a food bank. How do you reach them?
So you need to reach out to them. We have programming that is called Seniors for Shut-Ins, and organizations like Philabundance and so forth provide food, typical food for that type of age category, and we deliver that to them if they register in the pantry, and that goes on during the feeding time. And we may have anywhere from 6 to 8 great volunteers out there who are picking up commercial-oriented. Their limitation now is in their business. So you know what? They help us. And I'm talking about local businesses that chip in, like Miguel's Pharmacy and Kenny's World. And again, Mike Lanier's God's Daily Bread organization, pick up, help us deliver, and get it to those people who can't get out.
Let me read a tweet from Dan who says, my wife works at a pork manufacturer in Souderton, and part of what she was doing was coordinating donations, cool stuff, but the need is great. Anything you want to say in response to that, Reverend Wilkinson?
The need is great, and companies like that are just so helpful to us. We get donations from restaurants in our area, from retirement centers in the area, and it's just a real assistance to us, and the need is there. And whatever we have, we give away.
Yeah.
And there's very little that's left over.
Marty, we have an interesting contrast, is because the Reverend's method of the bags is so efficient and so well-placed to keep people in a healthy and nutritious state. We conceptualize a shopping pantry. It's just another way of kind of doing the same thing.
Yeah.
We had done bags way in the past, and as a board, we moved over to a shopping to enable people, to give them the respect of being able to shop and pick the food that they want right from the tables as they go down.
You know, that is the new model for food pantries, green light kind of approach. Mm-hmm. However, our space prohibits us from doing that kind of thing. And if we were to do it several times a week, we'd have to have a different way of organizing volunteers and organizing our very limited staff. But that is a good way. What we do is listen to our participants, and we know the things that they prefer and the things that are not so appealing to them. And so we try to purchase our foods in a way that we just don't seem to get any complaints about the bags.
Well, that's very good to know. You mentioned talking to the clients that you have there, and what kind of conversations do you have? I'll put that to you, Reverend Wilkinson, but also to you, Gerald Davis. And I'm wondering whether there are people who just are embarrassed, frankly, to stand in line for food.
Absolutely.
Can you take that first?
Absolutely. Again, this is the backside of hunger that we don't talk about very much. It is very difficult for somebody to come for food because it represents in their minds that somehow they have failed, somehow they are inadequate, somehow they don't meet the criteria for, a good person. And so when I talk to people, I learn that they've had downturns in their own economic situations. They may have lost a job. Very often they've had an illness or an injury that has made it difficult for them to work full time. We certainly know that mental illness is a problem. Education and lack of education, which precludes their getting livable employment. All of these things are factors in the lives of people who visit us.
I mean, it's like the hunger is the iceberg, right? The thing that you can see on top. And then there's
all this
stuff, I should say, underneath. Gerald, do you want to speak to that?
Marty, I think that we're past that. We were there for a long period of time leading up to this. There was embarrassment in regards to people showing up. There was some neighbor buying or picking up for another neighbor, et cetera. But you know what? In light of the position that we all find ourselves in, people don't have that resistance anymore, no reluctance. They need food. They have families that need food. And they're in line because they want to be in line and they want to help their families. We very rarely actually address homelessness. Homelessness has facilities like shelters and so forth that take care of them. We are more appropriate for the mother, the grandmother who might be raising two children, or the father who's out of work and has no income to put good food on the table. So those are the people that are showing up on a regular basis to take advantage.
Here are a couple of emails. One from Majid, who says, I represent a group of low-income seniors, and I'm trying to get boxes for us to deliver to their doors to discourage them from leaving their homes. Can any organization assist? And I'm not sure where Majid is, but I hear you want to speak to that, Reverend?
Well, in Delaware County, there's a group that has been working on this whole issue of getting food to families. And COSA is helping with this whole grocery situation for seniors. And you might call them here in Delaware County.
Yeah. And that's COSA, COSA?
Yes, the County of Delaware Services for the Aging, 215-900-2519. They also have a service where they are taking people to the grocery store and bringing them back.
And I know Philadelphia and other counties also have organizations for people who are older, for the elderly or the aged. Here's an email from Claire. What kind of wraparound services do you provide for your guests who come to you for food? How are you preparing people for life post-pandemic? Gerald Davis, can you take that?
I can. That's through volunteerism. And if we're going to get through this, it takes a village. As I've mentioned some places before, if an individual were to come into our place, United Health is there to help them with their Medicare, if they're having problems with Medicaid, et cetera, et cetera. As far as volunteers are concerned, if they want to do volunteering or they need volunteers to help, our CSEP program is there. You need partnership. That's what it comes down to provide wraparound services for people, anywhere from Miguel's Pharmacy, where they have prescription issues, down to housing, where we can call on different partners there who help. It really requires partnerships to help wrap around services.
Right.
And, Reverend, is it too soon to think or talk about post-pandemic, or should that always be on our minds?
I think it should always be on our mind. I think that what has happened is this exacerbation of crisis has pointed to some of the basic needs that we have as human beings. We've always had this need. And now we can look at policy that will inform practice. And I don't know that there's been that kind of attention for the most part.
But do you think that will be coming? I mean, there's so much focus now on all these needs that have been revealed.
Right. I think that it will happen because now we are talking about it very openly and without value judgment. Mm-hmm. And now we can take a look at What contributes to hunger? What are we doing about hunger? And what do we want to do going forward?
Gerald, do you want to add to that?
I do. Just like in preparing for this pandemic as a society, well, in a little glitch right here, we need to prepare for this for the future. I'm sure the Reverend would agree, as we need to establish this as if it was happening on a regular basis and we could respond to it. One of the major issues is we have had problems responding if you don't have partnerships and you're not prepared for that. Thank God we've been able to. A lot of the food pantries have scrambled and up their limit of providing to people, and it has helped substantially.
I just have to put a question to my guest. Sorry, to our engineer and to our producer who's down there in Philadelphia. Do we have our third guest waiting? Oh, she's there. Okay. I wasn't sure if she was there or not. Well, I do want to thank both of you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Reverend Zulene Wilkinson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And she's the head of Chester Eastside Incorporated. That's in Delaware County, again, just outside of Philadelphia. Gerald Davis, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Could I publicly thank one or two just to help us
along
the
ahead.
Way?
No, go right ahead.
Give them more incentive. Thank you, CSTEP, for helping us with the volunteers for the 55-plus program. Thank you, Phil Abundance and South Jersey Food Bank. You have really stepped up. And thank you, United Health and Allie Hackett, for both wraparound services and distribution. We appreciate it.
And again, that's Gerald Davis. He's head of Touch New Jersey in Camden. Well, we've been talking about the growing demand on food pantries because of the coronavirus shutdown. Even before this crisis, there were millions of Americans who were food insecure and still are. Philadelphia is the largest poor city in the country, with a quarter of the population living below the poverty line and thousands living in extreme poverty. Many are dependent on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, for their survival. We asked Marianna Chilton to join us to talk about how and why so many can be food insecure in such a wealthy country. Also, the connection between food insecurity and health. She's director of the Center for Hunger-Free Communities, and that's at Drexel University School of Public Health. And Marianna Chilton, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here. I mentioned this with Reverend Wilkinson, but I wanted to give you a chance to respond, because I do believe, and we've done so many shows over the last month or so, that this pandemic has revealed so many holes in our safety net. There are people who have health care and there are people who don't. There are people who get sick days and there are people who don't. There are people who get to work at home, like me and you, and there are those mm-hmm. who don't and end up losing their jobs. There are people that have enough food to eat. Their supermarkets still have shelves of food, and there are people who don't. Is this a wake-up call?
I sure hope it is. As you know, over the years, Marty, I've been trying to get people to wake up to the crisis of food insecurity and our inadequate safety net for years. And what I think what the COVID crisis has is like an unveiling of what's underneath America's problems. And if I, for lack of a better metaphor, I think about how the crisis of COVID is a little bit like Hurricane Katrina. You had and how it hit New Orleans. You had the hurricane hit, and then after the hurricane is over, the levees started to break. And what I see us doing now in our country is trying to stick our fingers in a dike, trying to stop a massive type of flood or massive problems with really major increases in hunger and homelessness, depression and illness that goes way beyond COVID. So it certainly has revealed major holes in our safety net. And I'd love to be able to talk about some of the things that are very positive about our safety net. But I do think this is a massive wake-up call, and we cannot just think about what's happening right now. We have to keep our eye on the future.
And I do want to get to all of that. And we were just talking with two heads of food pantries, you know, one in Chester, one in Camden, just outside of Philadelphia. And they do an extraordinary and important work. But at the same time, that's just a small piece of this food insecurity issue.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And as Reverend Wilkinson was saying, I got a chance to hear some of her comments, is that there's so much going on underneath food insecurity and hunger. You have problems with poor employment, with low wages, with homelessness, and that has to do with the marginalization of each other in our own society. So it's revealing a little bit about how much we really care for each other in our society and how much our government is paying attention. When families are food insecure, they have major problems with their health, and it's across the lifespan. So you can have, if a mother who's pregnant is food insecure, she's more likely to have a low birth weight baby. If an infant or a toddler is in a household that's food insecure, it's going to affect their cognitive, social, and emotional development. For school-age kids, they're going to have a really hard time concentrating. And then once people get older, adolescents and adults have major problems, not only with their physical health, but their mental health. And adolescents who experience food insecurity are more likely to try suicide or to think about it. Hmm. So it's a major problem across the lifespan, especially for our elderly. If an older person is food insecure, it's going to exacerbate issues of their cognitive functioning. It's going to exacerbate diabetes and heart disease, which makes them more susceptible to COVID and to big problems with having any kind of virus or flu. So food insecurity is, it has been a problem for our country for a long time. COVID is revealing a lot, and it's and the food insecurity issues are going to be exacerbated by COVID itself, but also by the economic shutdown.
Marianne, you've been on Radio Times before talking about food insecurity, but I just want to make sure our listeners know, when you say that, what does that mean? And that is the word that is used to describe this situation that we're talking about. But what does food insecurity actually mean for a person?
Yeah, sure. So the official definition of food insecurity is the lack of access to enough food for an active and healthy life. And what that indicates is it's not only the issue of having enough food, but it's also having the right kinds of food for an active and healthy life. So you can have a family that's maybe relying on pasta or noodles for weeks at a time. That means they're food insecure because they're having to cut the quality and the size of their meals and the frequency of their meals. And it can have major problems. It can cause major problems with health. And so I think it's really important to think of it not only as sort of a moral and a social crisis, but this is a public health problem that we've been trying to deal with for years and is only getting worse.
We're almost up on a break here, but, you know, here we are, such a wealthy country, even with the economic crisis that we're in, and there is food. I mean, we're reading about food that's being tossed because there isn't some kind of outlet for it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think about the first line of response is always to think about food, that food is the solution to food insecurity or hunger. And right. That's actually not true. It has a lot more to do with how much we actually help each other, what kinds of entitlements, access to basic needs, not just food, but housing, utilities, and a good paying job and support if they can't work. And it's extremely important to think about way beyond food in order to solve food insecurity.
Well, let's talk about that after this very short break. That's Marianna Chilton, and she's director of the Center for Hunger-Free Communities at Drexel University School of Public Health. We began talking about some food banks here or food pantries here in the Delaware Valley, but there are larger issues at stake. Do join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, and we will work you into this conversation. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, Marianna Chilton is our guest to end the hour. She's director of the Center for Hunger-Free Communities. That's at Drexel University School of Public Health. And we've been talking about the fact that there is so much insecurity even before the pandemic, which has had all sorts of economic and social implications. And we want you to join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times for questions or comments. Marianna, I was reading about Camden in preparation for our first guest, and about 75% of the people living in Camden get SNAP benefits. Let's talk a bit about what this benefit program is, what it does that you think is a benefit, and what it could do more.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought up SNAP, because it's an extremely important program and is really the first line of defense against hunger in America. And actually, I don't know about how many people in Camden, but that's a lot already, that 75% in Camden are on SNAP. In Philadelphia, there are currently about 450,000 people in the city that are on SNAP benefits. And that comes to the tune of about $58 million per month that the state releases to the city of Philadelphia to help feed people. So it's a massive program. It's extremely important. And so SNAP, we know, helps people to purchase their own groceries. They can have their own choice about what they buy, with a few exceptions. And it's an extremely important program. And as soon as the COVID virus hit, I think it's been fantastic. First of all, how the city responded with mm-hmm. making sure that there were more opportunities for families to get free food immediately. So the fact that there are 40 sites where people that are not related to SNAP, but emergency food. But at the state level, the Department of Human Services has applied for a number of different improvements to SNAP to help address the pandemic. The first one is the state has sought to increase the SNAP allotment amount to the maximum amount for every participant in the state. And for a family of three, that's about $500 a month. Now, that's great news in many ways. But one of the problems with the SNAP program is that the SNAP allotment is not enough to purchase a healthy diet. So we know that the vast majority of people who are on SNAP actually run out of money between the second and third week of the month. So while this is great that many families' SNAP benefits will increase, it can't go over that maximum amount. So there are a number of other improvements on the horizon that I hope I can mention, because SNAP really is a great way to get money into people's pockets where people will spend the money immediately.
Well, let's talk about what more can be done then.
Yeah. So one of the other things that's happening is that now that schools are closed, the state has done a phenomenal job of responding to ensure that kids who are on free breakfast and lunch can get access to meals. And so they've had a lot of sites where people can go and pick up food for their children, or, you know, not have the children have to show up. So they've been able to do that in the immediate term. But one of the new things that's on the horizon is something called Pandemic SNAP, which is SNAP dollars for all families who have a child on free breakfast or free or reduced breakfast and lunch. And so that will get about over $100 per child per month into the hands of families whose children rely on school breakfast and lunch. Right. And so that's a great way to utilize the infrastructure of SNAP to get more money into families' pockets. It's important to remember that about 50% of people who are on SNAP are children. So it's a really important child nutrition program as well.
And just to add, and this is not necessarily SNAP, but I know the Philadelphia School District, among other districts, is also making sure that there are these places where people can pick up food. I think it's called grab-and-go places, in order for kids that were getting food at school can get this food at home.
Yes, and as I was saying, that's a great sort of immediate response to ensure that families can get food. But I think that once the PSNAP or pandemic SNAP is available to families, I think that will be the choice response for families, because then it doesn't have to put families at risk to go and pick up food. It also doesn't there's a lot of time cost with having to go to a meal site to pick up the food for the kids.
Sure.
And it also gives more choice to families.
I mean, if people are running out, even if they're getting this benefit, but they're running out after the second or into the third week and running out of food or running out of money for food, is then one of the goals to increase how much money people get for SNAP so they won't run out of food?
Yes, that would be a very rational response. And there has been a strong push over the years to increase the amount of the SNAP benefits so that the actual calculation for the real cost of food is included in that SNAP calculation. And currently there are a number of legislators who are trying to ensure that in the next stimulus bill that there is an increase to SNAP benefits of 15% all across the board. That we know from our previous recession in 2008 and 2009, there was a 14% increase in SNAP benefits across the board. And we actually know through our research at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children that actually helped to prevent and stem an increase in hunger that was going to be there due to increasing unemployment. So it really is not only one of the best ways to help get money into families' hands and give them choice and help to protect their health and well-being, but it's a fantastic way to stimulate the economy, because for every $1 in SNAP benefits that's utilized, $1.50 in the local economy is created and generated. So it's there's a lot of benefits to increasing SNAP.
I mean, obviously, if people are dependent on this program, they don't have enough money in order to cover some of their basic necessities. I know one of the things that you've been talking about, and Andrew Yang talked about it on the campaign trail, is some form of a universal basic income, something to provide, I guess, some kind of a floor so that people don't fall into poverty.
Thanks. I'm so glad you mentioned it, because I think it's extremely important to consider universal basic income. And this is what I mean by shoring up our response to ensure that the basic needs of Americans are met, and also so that we can weather whatever future storm is coming. And they are coming because of our climate crisis and because of just the way we operate. So what is great about universal basic income is that It's an income floor that basically supports the cost of food and housing, utilities, and it can release a variety of problems that we have in our safety net. Number one, the huge administrative burden that states and the federal government has in ensuring that people are, quote, eligible for their SNAP benefits or for Medicaid or other kinds of supports, is that we spend a lot of time deciding on whether someone is eligible or not, whether they're following the rules, whether they're eligible after 6 months. Millions and millions of dollars gets wasted on ensuring, quote, eligibility, sort of income, income eligibility. What universal basic income does is basically says that we all agree that everybody should be able to meet their basic needs in terms of housing and food and utilities. And then that what happens is that that can actually help families stretch their dollars more. A lot of people get SNAP benefits, and sometimes they really need to buy diapers, or they need to buy tampons. They need to buy or cleaning supplies or hand sanitizer. They can't do that with their SNAP benefits. So it gives more freedom to families. It also reduces stigma. What happens is that when people are on SNAP, in the same way that you were talking about stigma receiving emergency food, or waiting in line, being seen waiting in line, people who are on SNAP are feel still very stigmatized against when they're in the grocery store. Even if they pull out their EBT card or the electronic benefits transfer card, they feel as if they're being judged by people behind them or by the grocery clerk. And what universal basic income does is it helps to reduce that stigma, and it basically sets a societal agreement on what we can actually tolerate. No one should be forced to work in a low-wage job in order to feed their families, or in order to put a roof over their heads. No one should have to be caught in that type of a position. Everyone has the right to food and the right to housing and to be able to have electricity. Those are basic and common, and we should respect that. So that's why I'm a great proponent of the universal basic income. It's going to take a while for us to figure that out as a country, but they've been doing all kinds of pilots around the world, and they find that it actually promotes employment, and it promotes health and well-being.
So the decision is that everybody, including Bill Gates, would get a certain amount of dollars every month. And as you said, it just gets rid of a lot of the bureaucracy and all the millions, probably even more than that, that are spent just trying to manage these systems.
Yes, I would agree. And so Bill Gates would get it, but then he'd have to give it back in taxes. What I like is that it creates, you know, it's people who are poor are considered to be just as worthy and wonderful as Bill Gates and others. But then in terms of taxes, those people who can should pay it back.
Is this also, again, you know, these are sort of lessons that we are learning, and we're sort of, you know, building this plane as we're flying it, but lessons that we are learning about the holes in our system, which is, if not, I don't know what you call it, Medicare for all, universal health care, but some system that covers people's health needs.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, those two things, universal health care is extremely important, and universal basic income should be, they are no-brainers for what to help to keep our society whole so that we don't sort of get into the point of social collapse. And I think what COVID has shown us is that people who were so worried about being able, you know, if they had to go to the hospital, they were worried about how they were going to even pay for their COVID treatment. How much does it cost to put me on a ventilator? Those are the kinds of concerns we should not have as a society, because it shows that some people are more valuable than others. So if we had universal health care and universal basic income, it would create a much better society and a much better baseline for people to stay healthy and well. The third universality should be universal child care. The fact that we have to pay so much for child care really limits the ability of families to be able to work and actually be there for their kids or to make sure that their kids are in healthy environments. So those are the three universalities are really important. There are two other types of solutions I'd love to be able to talk about beyond that universality, but I'll stop there if you wanted to.
I just want to quickly reintroduce you and find out what our listeners think about universal basic income, universal health care, universal child care. As we look forward, is that something that you think this country should embrace? Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And again, Marianna Chilton is our guest, director of the Center for Hunger-Free Communities at Drexel University School of Public Health. Marianna, go on. I know you've got a lot more up your sleeve there. Go ahead.
Well, I think what's exciting is that, you know, all of a sudden grocery workers are front line.
That's right.
And all of a sudden people are starting to appreciate the local grocery store and starting to think about how the actual food system works and the fact that there are cracks starting to happen in transportation systems in all around the world and in the United States where food can't get from one place to the other. And what it's showing and revealing are major problems in our food system. How much we rely on oil, how much we rely on produce grown in California or Florida to get to people in Philadelphia. And what I think is really exciting is that this is an opportunity for us to think about other ways to organize our food system. So I'm really interested, and I'm not the only one. I think across the country you see people who are interested in their local food system. What's happening locally? How can we support farmers locally? How can we support the fishermen and the other enterprises that are local? So the concepts of food sovereignty, of local regions actually having more control and understanding of what's going on in their own environment can actually help regions to be more agile in the face of another adversity coming. And it helps people to be able to, you know, do mutual aid societies, help your local farmer recognize where your food comes from. It's amazing that there are lots of places that are running out of seed. Everybody's starting to plant their own garden. So I think it's people are getting more interested in their connection with the planet, with nature, with their own food, and with our local food system, and seeing major problems with how much we rely on the oil industry and on big ag and on the big grocery stores. It's an exciting time to think about it.
Well, absolutely, and full of really important questions that we need to figure out the answers to. But as you mentioned when we began our conversation, that you've been working on this issue of food security or food insecurity for years now. So does it take a pandemic to get us to pay attention?
Yes.
She asks.
Yes. Yes, it does. Well, what I think it's scary. This is a scary time.
Frightening.
But the fact that everybody has had to stay in place, it forces everyone to stop and think and to reconsider. Whereas everybody's hustling to try to make money for food, try to make money for housing. The big companies were doing well. Airlines were flying everywhere. The fact that we have to stop and think, we can actually see a little bit more. So we don't want this pandemic, and I'm not grateful for it, but let's not waste this crisis to see what kind of miracles we can create ahead.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, but I'm thinking, you know, we've say this, we're all in this together. I mean, I think the question will be, depending on how we solve these problems, we'll know whether we are all in this together or not.
That's true. I think right now it's very clear that while that seems to be the, you know, line of the little tagline of politicians and big companies, it's very clear the fact that Black and Brown and Indigenous people are suffering the most during this crisis. It shows that we have massive problems with racism and discrimination and that colonialism is alive and well. And so that's why one of the other things that I hope we think about as we come out of this crisis is really thinking about reparations for Black and Brown communities and for Indigenous people, and think about giving land back so that Indigenous groups can assert their sovereignty and help to, create a more flourishing world for all of us.
Well, you always give us a lot to think about and talk about. Marianna Chilton, thanks so much for joining us today once again on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. I appreciate being here.
Absolutely. Director of the Center for Hunger-Free Communities, and that's at Drexel University School of Public Health. We talked with food bank leaders Zulene Wilkinson and Gerald Davis earlier in the hour. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Artie Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us.